Welcome to the 80th episode of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start off today with a check-in on the grape crop. Joining us on the phone is technical viticulturist with SunMade, Steve Vasquez. We wanted to talk today and just get an update on how grapes are looking and what grape growers should be thinking about at this time. So let's start off with the crop. What's going on with the crop and how are things looking?
Well, the crop just went through bloom, and we're going through shatter and set right now. So in talking with growers and visiting vineyards, the crop is looking pretty good, certainly compared to last year where we were, you know, anywhere between 25% and 50% off. This year, it looks like we're back to the industry average in terms of yields. And that's what I'm hearing from my colleagues in the wine grape industry and table grape industry. So, so far, so good this season.
All right. So what are some things that growers should be thinking about right now?
Well, you know, we started this season off kind of in a strange way because insects like leafhoppers came out really early. I mean, we had hoppers in vineyards when we had about, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 inches of growth, and now they've kind of disappeared. So we thought it was going to be a bad insect year, but it looks like insects currently, whether it's hoppers or mites, aren't too bad. The infamous vine mealybug is always a problem, and certainly this season is no different. You know, vine mealybug is out there and kind of moving up the trunk, especially with that warm weather that we had. And now that the clusters are starting to grow and fruit's going to start taking on sugar, I think vine mealybug certainly can be a potential problem. And then, you know, right now we're in the middle of a cool down for a little bit. And so, you know, we had all this heat and fast growth. And so powdery mildew certainly could be a problem this year, given the way the weather pattern is. You know, hot weather, fast growth, big canopies, and now we're in a cool down. And, you know, growers may have gotten behind a little bit with their fungicide applications. And so now they really need to be spot on those applications so powdery mildew does not take off and we don't end up with an epidemic like we had in 2019, which really impacted the crop.
Right. And so what should they, as you said, they need to be very aware of exactly what's going on in their crop right now to make sure that it's not a problem. But if they are starting to see a problem with that, with the powdery mildew, how quickly should they get after it and what should they do?
Yeah, I mean, they really, you know, growers need to be out, you know, making sure that their sprays, their intervals are, depending on the product that they're using, that are, you know, that they're spot on those intervals. So if they're using a 5 to 7 day material like dusting sulfur, they need to be in there every 5 to 7 days. If they're using some sort of DMI or QOI fungicide, then, you know, they need to be out there, you know, every 14 days or shorter, depending on, you know, the variety that they're growing. If they're growing a Chardonnay or a Fiesta or Autumn King, you know, all those three varieties are very susceptible to powdery mildew. They really need to be vigilant, out scouting and making sure that their intervals, their fungicide intervals, are what they should be to be managing powdery mildew really well. Don't want to let that get away from you, because once it does, then it's a real challenge to go through and clean it up, and it's a lot more work and a lot more costly. So got to stay on top of powdery mildew and application timing.
Right. And like you said, just be very vigilant with it.
Yes.
What about nutrition? What should we be thinking about with nutrition at this point?
Well, with berries starting to grow, I mean, growers should have taken their tissue test at bloom time and have gotten those back and really look at their potassium program and see whether they're in need of that, balance that with the size of crop that they have and, you know, the type of crop that it is. You know, for us at SunMade, someone who's growing raisins on an overhead versus just a single wire Thompson seedless variety. You know, those two fertilizer programs are going to look very different. You're talking about maybe 2 tons of fruit, dried fruit, versus, you know, 4 to 6 tons of dried fruit. The demand for potassium is going to be very different for those two. And so you need to, growers should get together with their certified crop advisor and develop a plan that matches the type of yield that they're looking to harvest this year.
All right. And then, of course, you know, no California agriculture interview is complete until you talk about water. Grapes obviously need water. So how is that looking? I know we've had some, you know, disappointing weather as far as water goes and the amount of dryness. What would you like to tell the grape growing listeners?
Well, yeah, and water is always, really, water makes the world go around, right? So, you know, for grape growers, certainly in the valley, you know, the irrigation districts, I think, are going to start deliveries here in the next week to 10 days. And so I know a lot of growers are depending on, you know, the one or two opportunities that they're going to have to use canal water. Which is going to be helpful, certainly in terms of cost and just quality. You know, some of the wells that people are drawing from can be high in nitrates or high in boron or other salts that can cause problems for grapes. And so I know growers are definitely looking forward to having some ditch water and being able to supplement their water needs this year. You know, growers, we're at the end of May, so growers are really going to have to watch their vines and see where they're at and make sure that they're, you know, they're adequately watered given our temperatures that the forecasters are saying we're going to be experiencing. If we have another really hot summer and we have a much bigger crop than we did last year, water is going to play an important role in growing that crop and then maintaining that crop until the end, until it gets harvested. So spend some time with your certified crop advisor to determine what the needs are, both, you know, in terms of nutrition and water. I think that's going to be big this year. We'll see where that takes us at the end of the season.
All right. I think that's everything, unless you have anything else that you think our listeners need to know.
Eat more grape products, raisins, table grapes, and wine. That's all I've got.
Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Our news brief for today. From the California Farm Bureau, pouring water onto farmland in the wintertime could help nearby communities replenish their groundwater supplies. University of California research shows nearly 300 rural communities could benefit from the managed aquifer recharge. The research is part of ongoing work to determine how flooding farmland in the winter could refill underground water supplies. Scientists have been charting the impact on aquifers and on the crops and farmland involved. Increasing drought out west is increasing concerns of cattle producers about reducing stocking rates to assure proper forage and feed. Rod Bain reports.
As drought expands in much of the west,
we're
right now in the primary growing season for many range and pasture grasses in this region. April through July is really a critical period for forage and grass growth across much of the western United States.
And University of Nebraska livestock specialist Aaron Berger says that then the challenge posed to cattle producers is...
We're looking at a situation where feed prices are high, and so the alternatives they have in terms of what they can do to try to maintain cattle herds becomes pretty challenging for them.
So as producers understand what their forage production is in pastures and rangeland, they determine what can be grazed by livestock to maintain or improve feed resources, what is known as stocking rates. So in times of drought...
To reduce the amount of defoliation or grazing that occurs, that means we're going to need to reduce the number of animals that are grazing or the length of time that they're grazing. And so that's what we're doing, is we're thinking about reducing stocking rate.
How that can be done, according to Berger, is through one of three main options. The first is supplementing or substituting feed, such as feeding cattle on pasture.
Supplemental feeding is an option when, again, we have feed available, but maybe the forage quality is not what we would like. When we're thinking about substitute feeding, we're in a situation here where we're trying to replace some of the forage we normally would graze with a harvested forage resource or feed resource, and we're actually replacing some of the feed that we would graze with cattle with harvested feed.
With caution expressed about cattle feeding on native range causing damage to forage plants. Another stocking rate reduction option is shipping cattle. However,
this year, with really how widespread the drought is, I think that's a little more challenging. There's kind of an old adage that says you can ship cattle north and west, but you can't send them south and east. And my experience would be, and also working with producers, is that's true.
Due to differing environments and forage, as well as the challenge of livestock to adapt. Other risk regarding shipping of cattle.
If you're bringing those cattle back to your operation, of bringing back a disease or a potential problem, things like reproductive diseases, things like anaplasmosis, another problem as well.
A third option for producers to reduce stocking rates is selling cattle.
We need to think about what's the long-term plan for the business. What are our options? What's the projected value of those cows over the next 2 to 5 years? Also thinking about what cattle in your operation give you the greatest flexibility if this drought should be long-term.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
In a development that could improve the drought tolerance of crops, University of California scientists say they've identified genes that protect plants from drying out. Working with tomato plants, the UC researchers studied genes that regulate a moisture barrier layer in the plant roots. The barrier prevents a plant from losing water. The scientists say the new knowledge may help them breed crops that survive longer during drought. People have been buying more strawberries during the pandemic, which has increased demand for the starter plants that farmers use to grow the crops. Northern California nurseries that produce strawberry transplants report receiving more orders as every growing region in North America increased plantings to meet customer demand. Plant breeders have also been developing strawberry plants that yield more berries per acre and resist plant diseases while retaining high flavor. The new wheat marketing year is shaping up to be very promising for U.S. wheat growers. Gary Crawford has more.
U.S. wheat growers put in about 33 million acres of winter wheat last fall.
That's the first year-over-year increase we've seen since 2013.
However, Lance Honig with USDA Statistics Service says...
Our first forecast of harvested area for grain, though, is 24.6 million acres. That's up 6.9% year-over-year.
But the gap between planted and harvested still quite large, quite a bit of abandonment.
Some of the persistent dry conditions out there across much of the key growing area having an impact.
But for the winter wheat left to be harvested.
Our first yield forecast, 52.1 bushels per acre. That's up 2.4% or 1.2 bushels per acre from last year's final yield.
It would be the third highest yield ever.
Putting our first production forecast of the season for winter wheat at 1.28 billion bushels.
Up 9.6% from last year's winter wheat crop, and obviously for all wheat.
We see a little bit of an increase in production.
New voice there, and a good increase in price, by the way. This from USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski. USDA forecasting an all-wheat crop for the U.S. for the 21-22 year of 1,872 million bushels, up 46 million from this past season. But despite that...
Ending stocks actually tighten up a bit, down to about the lowest in about 7 years.
Taking average prices up 29% to a projected $6.50 a bushel. But, of course, at that price,
our export competitiveness is starting to slip a little bit.
Not just from rising prices, but from higher global wheat production.
Production is expected to be a record, and we see pretty strong increases in places like the European Union and in Ukraine. Also in Northwest Africa, they're expecting a big recovery in their wheat production. So supplies for the new crop year will be up globally.
And our exports forecast down about 6.5%. But Mark says in the U.S., those high corn prices and poor forage conditions are expected to cause
livestock producers to use more wheat in feed rations.
70% more. So yes, fewer wheat exports expected, but more domestic use. And bottom line, regardless,
prices stay high. That's all that matters, whether that's being fed domestically or exported. It's all the same price that the farmer is receiving.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The USDA published its 90-day progress report on climate-smart agriculture and forestry this week. The agency says it represents an important step toward President Biden's executive order on tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad, and the shift toward a whole-of-department approach to solutions. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack said in a statement, "With the right tools and partnerships, American agriculture and forestry can lead the world in solutions that will increase climate resistance, as well as sequester carbon, enhance agricultural productivity, and maintain critical environmental benefits." That's our news brief for today. When we come back, we're talking about lamb. We'll be right back.
My Ag Life, calendar of events. Here's Taylor Chalstrom with what's happening around the state.
On May 24th to the 27th, we have the 39th Annual Almond Alliance Convention. On May 24th to the 28th, we have the Virtual Climate Action and Agriculture Symposium put on by UCCE San Diego. On May 25th, we have a webinar for glyphosate alternatives and organic herbicides in landscapes. And on May 26th, we have a UC Ag Experts Talk webinar on soil-borne pathogen management in Southern California high-value crops. Check out those events and more at myaglife.com. And don't forget that registration is now open for the 2021 Almond Day, hosted by West Coast Nut on June 15th, 2021. It's going to be a virtual event with CEU credits offered.
Get more details at myaglife.com.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The American Lamb Board is promoting the industry for the warmer months with a campaign on outdoor cooking. Joining us to talk more about that is Gwendolyn Kitzan, Chair of the American Lamb Board.
The American Lamb Board is looking at outdoor cooking for summer. So tell me a little bit about the Lamb Board's Outdoor Cooking Adventures campaign and what the goal is for this.
Well, this is such a fun campaign because everybody loves grilling outdoors. The Great Outdoors Cooking and Grilling Campaign, you know, it's such a fun adventure for so many people across the country. And now the American Lamb Board, our Outdoor Cooking and Adventure Campaign, aims to help consumer bring these two passions of cooking and being outside, you know, to come to a true kind of a test, but a fun test where we're going to compete against each other a little bit to share this great flavor of American lamb. Now, the campaign is going to feature a recipe contest that challenges these outdoor enthusiasts to showcase their favorite outdoor recipe using American lamb through short videos. Now, the American Lamb Board has also paired up with chefs and pitmasters and outdoor cooking experts to help develop and share a variety of American lamb recipes and videos for grilling, smoking, and my favorite, over-the-fire cooking.
Nice. So during the summer months, my husband and I grill outdoor just about every night. So this sounds like something that if we shot a video of him grilling, that would could be part of the kind of the contest, the campaign.
Oh, absolutely. And it is such a great contest that we're having, you know, because right now, you know, everybody is so tired of being cooped up inside in the summer months and the fresh air and grilling. Wow. You know, and we have so much great American lamb that it just mixes it all up and brings the flavor of summer. So, and the other interesting thing that we found out that, you know, we had a poll that we were looking at that it says, you know, this outdoor dining, it's here to stay, especially after March of 2020, where, you know, over a third are interested in experimenting and trying and enjoying American lamb with their outdoor cooking.
So I want to look at two different angles from this because, our primary listenership, of course, are people in the ag industries, but then also, of course, this goes out online, so a lot of consumers listen as well. So tell me, let's start with consumers. What can consumers expect from this campaign?
This campaign, everybody loves to cook, and this is going to, and there's so many wonderful flavors, depending on the different region of the United States, that they're going to be able to take videos and post it online on the AmericanLamb.com website under the contest and share their favorite recipes with a chance to win a $500 Cabela gift card, which, of course, you can go buy for more outdoor grilling or for outdoor summer events.
Fun. That is a great prize.
It is a great prize, you know, and it's a win-win situation for everyone. But I guess the beauty of it is, you know, that our American culture is so diverse and everybody loves to eat lamb. And this is a great place to pull everybody and really include them and make them part of our American lamb family.
All right. So tell me a little bit about from the industry side, how does this campaign really work for the industry?
Well, you know, the other thing we just got done with the American Lamb Board doing is for the industry is we participated in Memphis in May, which is the World Champion Barbecue Cooking Contest, which is the largest competition in the country. There was over 150 competing teams that were offered American lamb shoulders and ribs. I love lamb ribs. And these all were supplied by Superior Farms to use at this festival and to enter into the exotic meat competition. Now, this festival gave the American Lamb Board an opportunity to network with all these incredible pitmasters and barbecue influencers and to help post videos and everything online so the consumers can go ahead and experiment and enjoy more American lamb. And in that, in turn, will also help get more American lamb on the consumer plates, which also always helps our American producers.
Right. Of course. And, you know, it's all about getting the product out there onto the plates.
It always is. That's the bottom line is always, you know, we have to get it from, you know, nobody can raise American lamb. We have producers who specialize in this. They know what they're doing. And the flavor truly comes out on the plate.
Now, can you tell me a little bit more about just the American Lamb Board itself?
Okay. Of course, the American Lamb Board, you know, we're the checkoff branch of the sheep industry. And so we're always very, very focused on is returning value added back to the consumer's dollars or the producer's dollars. That is really critical that we do that. And so right now with the American Lamb Board, if you go on AmericanLamb.com, there is actually a campaign toolbox there, and it is full of graphics and videos, beautiful, beautiful photos of all different types of cuts of lamb. Now, the producers, we can go on there and we can upload this and you can use, as a producer, any pieces of those materials because you have paid into your lamb checkoff. And you can use those at your local farmers markets, your events, or through social media.
Nice. So they can help promote the product themselves. And, you know, and I think that is important. We have seen in so many different ways and with so many different aspects of the ag industry that when it's the farmers the ranchers, the producers themselves, really telling people about their product, it helps the general population understand more.
You're absolutely right. Because what happens is nobody can tell the story of their product like the producers. We know our consumers in that area. We know what they like. And we can tell the passionate story because we're there 24/7, 7 days a week with these animals and take such great pride in what we do.
Absolutely. All right, Gwendolyn, is there anything else that you think the listeners should know about?
Well, you know, I just always want to thank the American consumer for buying American products and really supporting our American egg families. Times are always so interesting, and there's a lot of weather challenges and market challenges. And we feed this food with pride to our families, and it's always with pride that we're able to serve it to our American consumers.
There's more to come. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Keeping an eye on our national lawmakers, in Thursday's Senate proceedings, senators voted on whether or not to continue building the border wall. It was an amendment to the Endless Frontier Act, which focuses on advancing technology in the U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, brought an amendment on immigration to the Technology Act. The amendment would have honored existing contracts and built an additional 250 miles of border wall that was initiated under the previous presidential administration. Here is part of Senator Johnson's presentation for his amendment.
Mr. President, there was a time, and it really wasn't all that long ago, when securing the border had bipartisan support. It was actually a bipartisan goal. I think that made a lot of sense, but it's not now. And it wasn't all that long ago. In 2006, Congress passed something called the Secure Fence Act of 2006. What that piece of legislation did is it authorized 700 miles of what was supposed to be double-layer fencing. Now, in the end, only 36 miles of actual double-layer fencing was constructed. Another 613 miles, consisting of about 299 miles of vehicle fencing. In other words, people could just walk right through it. And another 314 miles of single-layer pedestrian barrier fencing was actually built. I think we've seen that, unfortunately, that fencing did not fulfill the requirements of the Secure Fence of 2006, and it also didn't work. Now, what's interesting to know about the passage of the Secure Fence Act is it passed overwhelmingly in this chamber by a vote of 80 to 19. 26 Democrat senators joined the 54 Republicans voting yes. It also passed the House in a pretty overwhelming margin as well, 283 to 138, with 64 Democrats joining Republicans. So in total, the total count in Congress was 363 votes to build a fence and secure the border versus 157 people that apparently didn't have an interest. In other words, 70% of members of Congress voting on the Secure Fence Act, voting for border security, voted yes. And again, that was with the support of 90 Democrats. By the way, some pretty notable Democrats voted to secure the border by building 700 miles of double-layer fence, including those who are current President Biden, former President Barack Obama, current Majority Leader of the Senate, Senator Schumer, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, my chairman and ranking member of Homeland Security, Senator Tom Carper, the chairwoman of Judiciary in the past, Senator Feinstein, the current chairman of the Finance Committee, Senator Wyden. At the time, Senator from Ohio, Senator Brown, was a member of the House, and he voted for it in the House. So again, that's only 14, 15 years ago when securing the border was actually a bipartisan goal. What happened? Why isn't that the case now? Why has securing the border become a partisan issue? Well, politics happened. I wasn't here between 2006 and 2011, but I know there are multiple good faith efforts to pass an immigration bill. They often refer to it as comprehensive immigration reform. I remember when I got here, that effort was still going on, and we actually passed this body a comprehensive immigration bill. I remember talking to Senator McCain, who is one of the leading proponents, and I did suggest that I would stop using the word comprehensive. I don't think we do a very good job of things comprehensively here. We ought to take a step-by-step approach. Senator McCain was not real happy with my comment there, but I made it anyway. I still think, quite honestly, the test of time has probably proven me right. Bipartisanship pretty well ended, the efforts, when that effort failed in the House. Didn't move it any further. We had a split chamber. And so the Obama administration got impatient. And I understand the frustration. I want to fix the problem. I want to take care of now probably adults that came here as children through no fault of their own, the DACA kids. I think most members of the chamber want to do that. But you have to do it a legal way. And you have to do it a step-by-step approach, starting with securing our border. And I'll talk about that a little bit further, but let me just talk about what the effect of deferred action on childhood arrivals had. It's pretty obvious by this chart. You can see this goes back to 2007, and the red bar is just talking about unaccompanied children apprehended at the southwest border. You can see through 2011, at most, we had a little over 4,000 unaccompanied children coming across the border illegally and being apprehended. And then, obviously, America, we have to take care of them because we're compassionate. In June of 2012, the Obama administration issued the DACA memorandum. The result was almost immediate. It was a magnet. It was a pull factor. It was used by the coyotes in Central America. So they would tell people that want to come into America, and let's face it, who wouldn't want to be in America? I'm highly sympathetic with people who want to come to America, take advantage of this land of opportunities. But the coyotes would tell the migrants down in Central America, they've changed their laws. Come in, come in, come with us. We'll take you up to the border. We'll get you across the border, and then you'll get a slip. They'll call it a permiso, which is really a notice to appear. And so they came. They came in such quantities that in 2014, more than 51,000 unaccompanied children flooded our border, and President Obama rightly declared that a humanitarian crisis, and it was. That humanitarian crisis at that point in time entailed about 2,000 people coming and being apprehended at the border, 2,000.
The amendment needed 60 votes to pass, but ultimately only got 46. That's our show for today. If you'd like to send me a comment, you can email me at sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.